Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
In Sudan, two men, once allies, are now going head-to-head in a deadly battle.
The end game for both of them seems to be the total annihilation of the other.
We'll hear more about the general taking on Sudan's military. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Syria's president is being sued in a U.S. court for mistreatment of prisoners. The sister of a man in Syrian detention is clear-eyed about what the case can do.
For me, it's more about preserving our narratives, telling the world about our suffering.
And a first at Coachella. A Palestinian artist sings in Arabic. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you here. We start today in Sudan, where fighting erupted over the weekend between the Sudanese army and a paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Dozens of people have been killed, and because fighting is happening in many parts of Sudan, more fatalities are expected. The battles have also cut off power for millions of people in the capital, Khartoum. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
It's the final days of the holy month of Ramadan. Residents of Khartoum would normally be relaxing during their fast. Instead, they're getting hit by gunfire and are under aerial attack. For 3 days now, the Sudan Armed Forces, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, have been fighting the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, a paramilitary force led by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, popularly known as Hemeti. Khalil Yusuf al-Nur is a resident of Khartoum.
There's a clouds of smoke. They're coming from the middle of Khartoum.
I ask him what he's been hearing.
A gunshot, like a machine gun and a heavy gun.
This is the deadly showdown that many people warned could come. Khaloud Kher runs a think tank called Confluence Advisory in Khartoum. She says tensions between the Sudan Armed Forces and RSF have been high for years. They got worse when dictator Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019.
Since then, they have been working independently. They have different foreign policies, different income streams, and different sorts of domestic policies or ideas about how to consolidate first their power grab in 2019 and then their coup in 2021.
Kher says both have been engaged in a struggle for power, even as they engaged in negotiations geared towards transitioning the country back to civilian rule. Last week, those negotiations broke down as they disagreed on how to restructure the military.
Both now want to have control over Sudan, to having control of Khartoum.
Both generals have made appearances in the media since fighting broke out. They had similar messages, that they are the ones protecting the interests of the Sudanese people and that the other is an enemy of the country. Kher says the battle on the streets is also playing out on social media. Both sides have shared videos purporting to show victories in strategic locations.
They're trying to convince people that they should back their position. I think the biggest miscalculation is that they don't understand. Neither Burhan nor Hemeti understand that the people of Sudan, particularly people in Khartoum, don't want either general.
Fighting has already led to the death of dozens of civilians caught in between and to the destruction of major infrastructure, including hospitals and the international airport in Khartoum. Fadl Mahmoud lives less than a mile from there.
The gunshot, the bombs, they never stop. They may stop for half an hour, a hour. But, you know, they resume again.
Mahmoud says this conflict is making observing this holy month of Ramadan much harder. Residents of Khartoum are having to make decisions about whether to risk their lives to go out and do simple things, like charging their phones or finding food, water, or medicine.
Wallahi, the electricity is out here. Because we are close from the conflict. And the supermarkets, you know, in the small ones are open, but the big ones in the street, they are closed.
On Sunday, the UN said that both generals agreed to a temporary humanitarian ceasefire, but it was only partially observed. Today, fighting continued. That sound sent to me from a resident in Khartoum earlier today. I asked Khalid Kher, the analyst, what the end game is for both forces.
The end game for both of them seems to be the total annihilation of the other.
Neither outcome is good, she said. Kher says that there's an urgent need for a high-level intervention to try and de-escalate this conflict. On Saturday, Sudan's former civilian prime minister, Abdalla Hamdok, delivered a public message. Hamdok urged the generals to stop the fighting and warned that a war in Sudan will mean war for the entire region. Over the weekend, emergency meetings were held by the African Union, the Arab League, and other regional bodies to discuss the conflict. Kenya said yesterday that their president, along with the presidents of Djibouti and South Sudan, would travel to Sudan to try and mediate. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
So who is General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti or Little Mohamed? And what is the history of the rapid support forces that he leads? Alex DeWall is an expert on Sudan at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. He's also the executive director of the World Peace Foundation. Alex, it's kind of extraordinary that a country ends up with two heavily armed forces that are prepared to throw some very heavy weaponry at each other. Take us back to the origins of the RSF and Hemeti himself.
So the RSF began some 20 years ago. I think many listeners will remember the terrible war and atrocities in Darfur, in which Arab militia were mobilized to fight against non-Arab African insurgents in Darfur and committed terrible massacres. And the pact with the devil that was made by the then president, Omar al-Bashir, was that because the army wasn't up to the task, he would mobilize these militia. And the leader of that is a very capable, skillful military operator, Hemeti.
And Hemeti, it's my understanding, he comes from a tribe of livestock herders. How and why did he join such a force like the Janjaweed?
He's a very capable military operator and a very skillful, won battles and was the favorite of the former president. His key to his rise has been his business acumen. His militia took over artisanal gold mines in Darfur, and gold has become a key source of finance and revenue for Sudan. And that gold is transported to the United Arab Emirates and, under cooperation with the Wagner Group of Russian mercenaries, to Moscow itself.
So you mentioned the role of former dictator Omar al-Bashir in Sudan. Does Hemeti owe his rise solely to Bashir?
Hemeti rose because of Bashir and because of Bashir's generals. And one of those generals, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who was a very close collaborator with Hemeti in Darfur, is now his arch rival. And the two men are duking it out for control of the Sudanese state.
So in 2019, Bashir was overthrown. What do we know about the relationship of the RSF, Hemeti's forces, with Sudan's national military before and after the 2019 protests and this kind of misbegotten transition to democracy?
The RSF was really a parallel force. The army didn't like them, but needed them there as a strike force for fighting the wars that the army itself was not able to fight. So Hemeti was a de facto member of the National Security Council that really controlled Sudan. And as such, he was a member of that cabal of senior officers that overthrew their patron and mentor, President Bashir, in the name of the people, but really with the intent of seizing power for themselves.
Right. And now they're bitter rivals. Where does the RSF draw their support from? Do they have any foreign backing?
They get some backing from the United Arab Emirates, which has been very sympathetic to them. They have a partnership, a commercial partnership with the Wagner Group of Russian mercenaries.
How popular is Hemeti with the people of Sudan?
Well, quite a lot of the people see Hemeti as the one force that stands between them and General Burhan imposing an Egyptian-style dictatorship on the country. So he has some support among the population and also support among his own constituency of Darfurian Arabs. But I think all Sudanese are horrified by both sides in this rapidly unfolding civil war.
Alex DeWall is a professor at Tufts University and the executive director of the World Peace Foundation. He joined us from Medford, Massachusetts. Alex, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
The island of Bali in Indonesia is a tropical playground for tourists, Western tourists especially. They're drawn to its beauty and cheap prices. But Indonesian officials worry the island has become a little too inviting to troublemakers. So the government is coming up with a range of proposals to weed out misbehaving foreigners. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story. What exactly are tourists doing in Bali, Patrick, that's upsetting Indonesian officials?
Lots of things. So it usually comes down to either flouting the law or the local conservative culture. So for example, just this week, a tourist posted photos of her getting butt naked and hugging a sacred tree at a Hindu temple. She's actually the second foreigner to do that at that tree. So that sort of thing gets locals upset. There's also this heavy flurry recently of online videos showing foreigners just acting entitled. A recent one features a shirtless American guy getting stopped by traffic cops in Bali for riding a motorbike without a helmet, and he loses his temper, calling them corrupt.
Yeah, you want to steal money? You want to steal money? You want to steal?
And that clip was actually cited by one of Indonesia's top government ministers as emblematic of Bali's bad tourist problem and how it's getting worse.
So what are some of the proposals to keep troublemaking tourists away from the island?
Two things are happening: heavier enforcement of existing laws, and there's proposals for new tactics. So they are stepping up deportations. They're throwing out more than 600 people just this year for disruptive behavior or overstaying their visas. And then the government is also presenting this moral code to travelers, which is no swimwear outside the beach, no scandalous social media posts, no public drunkenness, and so on. The more controversial proposal is a substantial entry fee. Exactly how much that would be is up in the air, but it would have to be high enough to scare off the cheapskate party crowd, which Indonesians call bad bule. Bule is their word for Westerners. The only precedent for this in the region is Vietnam, which charges about $50 for every tourist right at the airport. For Bali, this would be totally new territory.
Interesting. So I'm thinking, Patrick, such rules could make tourism less enjoyable and might keep some people away. Is there any local opposition to these proposals for that or any other reasons?
There is. There's basically two camps. There's the business-oriented lobby, hotel and resort owners, which say, look, let them in. We need the money. There's been a surge of people coming to Bali since COVID restrictions were lifted. And they would say, this is great. Let's fire up the economy. But more and more, everyday Balinese seem fed up with foreigners treating the island like it's theirs. One of the big local gripes are foreigners moving to Bali on tourist visas and overstaying their visa for months or years, working without the proper documents. The Balinese response is, wait a minute, you're from wealthy Western countries. We see how your governments treat undocumented immigrants, so have some respect for our laws. No one knows if a $50 or $100 entry tax would fix that problem. What I have heard talking to Balinese politicians is, please come. We enjoy your tourist dollars, but always remember you're a guest here, so act like a guest.
The World's Patrick Nguyen. Thanks very much, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
Former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is back in his country after spending 3 months in the United States. Has his popularity declined back home, or will he be able to revive his movement? That's still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. One of Russia's most outspoken opposition activists, Vladimir Karamurza, was sentenced today to 25 years in prison. Karamurza was found guilty of treason for criticizing Russia's war in Ukraine. The 25-year sentence is the longest an opposition figure in Russia has received since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Sergei Davidis is the head of the Independent Political Prisoner Support Group, Memorial, and Karamurza's friend. Davidis joins us from Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. Sergei, what was your reaction to the court's decision today?
Unfortunately, it could be foreseen, but for sure, in spite of that, it's somehow unexpected. I'm so sorry that Vladimir proved to be in this situation and that he got this sentence. In spite of the fact that it was his choice to return back to Russia, and in spite of the fact that it could be foreseen that he will get so long prison term, it was somehow unexpected.
Yeah, I mean, not totally surprising, the conviction, but some observers were expecting maybe 20 years for Vladimir Karamurza. Were you surprised by 25 years as an especially long sentence?
Actually, I think it's a kind of revenge. It's not a rational decision because there are two main aims the state pursues when delivers these sentences: to stop public activity of its opponents and to prevent such an activity showing the example of prosecution. But they could just charge Vladimir with spreading fake news about Russian army and sentence him to 8 years, 8 years and a half. But they preferred also to charge him with state treason. And everything only because of his public speech about human rights, about the war crimes Russian forces commit in Ukraine.
The whole world sees what the Putin regime is doing to Ukraine, the cluster bombs on residential areas, the bombings of maternity wards and hospitals and schools, the war crimes. These are war crimes that are being committed by the dictatorial regime in the Kremlin.
I think it's a kind of revenge for his activity to promote personal sanctions on those perpetrators against human rights.
So the judge took only minutes to rule 25 years in prison, the longest such sentence for an opposition figure since Russia invaded Ukraine. How long did the whole trial last, and what can you tell us about how the court case was managed by the government?
Actually, the trial was closed, so we could only get information from Vladimir's lawyers. It was not open for media. We could not read reports. Nobody could visit the trial. So, for sure, it was not fair trial, but it could not be fair because the charges themselves were unlawful.
It's interesting, in some of his remarks in court, which were actually printed by the Washington Post, Karamurza said his arrest and trial were echoes of the Stalinist past, and also said, like that period in Russian history, it will end and people will see this current regime for what it is. Sergei, step back for a second. What does this sentence tell us about this moment in Russia's history?
It shows that the level of cruelty, of violence from Russian authorities became very high. And the general situation with human rights for sure is quickly deteriorating. But his special case shows that the authorities are so irritated with him and they are ready to throw away all the attempts to show something legal, something lawful, to prosecute their enemy. Any crime is possible for them, I think. They will do everything to keep their authority, to keep their power.
Sergei Davidis is the head of the Independent Political Prisoner Support Group, Memorial, talking to us about the conviction and sentencing today in Moscow of Russian opposition politician Vladimir Karamurza. Sergei, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is back in his country after 3 months in Florida. His allies say their leader has returned to fight the government of his successor, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. But Bolsonaro has a string of lawsuits against him, and there are real doubts about his ability to lead. Michael Fox has our story.
Brazil's former firebrand President Jair Bolsonaro came home last month to applause from allies and supporters. They chanted, "The captain has returned," as he entered the headquarters of his party. Welcome, Liberal Party President Valdemar da Costa Neto told a smiling Bolsonaro over a packed crowd. "You were missed and you'll always be missed because the movement that you built in Brazil is here to stay." Those sentiments were echoed by Rogério Marinho, the congressional leader of the party, in an interview with CNN Brazil.
O presidente Bolsonaro hoje, independente das críticas que são feitas,
there is no doubt that Bolsonaro today represents a movement with values and a virtuous economic legacy, Marinho said. In Congress, Bolsonaro's party has the largest number of seats in the lower house, though far under a majority. Marcelo Kunroth is a Brazilian political sociologist.
Mas, obviamente, ele coordena e mobiliza setor, e talvez setor mais
radicalizado. He obviously has the ability to mobilize perhaps the most radicalized and highly visible sector of the opposition, which is the extreme right that is in the National Congress, says Kunroth. But will he effectively be able to assume a leadership role among his larger base? That's another question, he says. Kunroth explains that Bolsonaro's supporters among the far right, evangelicals, and the military are not necessarily aligned as an opposition, and that Bolsonaro has lost strength since last year.
Me parece que o Bolsonaro ele volta, essa ida para os Estados Unidos fragiliza.
He's coming back from the United States in a much weaker position, he says, because of the time he was silent while in Brazil after the election, and then his time away, he says. And don't expect any massive pro-Bolsonaro street protests anytime soon. The January 8th Capitol invasion by far-right Bolsonaro supporters did not turn out well. Protesters were arrested. The invasion was widely condemned by society and Brazil's political class, even Bolsonaro allies. The Supreme Court has ordered Bolsonaro to testify this week over his alleged role in the January 8th attack. The former president also faces at least 6 lawsuits for alleged illegal acts while president, among them abuse of power for attacking Brazil's voting system. A conviction could block him from running in elections for up to 8 years. Brazilian political scientist Larissa Peixoto says that while Bolsonaro has led the far right in Brazil in recent years, it doesn't mean he'll continue to do so.
So the movement that is attached to Bolsonaro isn't necessarily a Bolsonaro movement. So they will call themselves Bolsonaristas, but the right in Brazil has had other figureheads, has had other heroes, and they tend to just be swapped over for someone else.
And others are being groomed.
O PL é o partido que mais valoriza a mulher.
Last month, former First Lady Michelle Bolsonaro was appointed to head the women's branch of the Liberal Party, her first political position. She's a devout evangelical who campaigned hard for her husband last year. This is Brazil. Anything can happen, but one thing is clear. The Trump of the tropics is back home, and his people are excited. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. 30,000 people ran the 26.2 miles of the Boston Marathon today. They came from all corners of the earth. This runner from Nova Scotia had 3 goals.
One is to enjoy myself. 2 is to finish. 3 is to finish under 6 hours.
We'll hear how she and the winners did today, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The war in Ukraine has united NATO allies. All told, NATO member countries have sent more than $70 billion in military aid to the government in Kyiv to help thwart Russia's full-scale invasion. At the same time, NATO also has to keep its eyes on global arms control. The annual NATO Conference on Arms Control, Disarmament, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, Nonproliferation, begins today in Washington. Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins, the U.S. Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, is chairing the gathering. She's here with us to explain what's in store and what's at stake. Ambassador Jenkins, I don't need to tell you, this is a very tense time for the globe, and while it's headlining the agenda, global arms control is probably not what's on the minds of NATO allies right now. What is going to dominate this conference?
So it's really an opportunity for us to get together and really consider what is the future of arms control, nonproliferation, and disarmament. So many multilateral ways in which we can all work together to ensure safety for the global community.
The war in Ukraine is, of course, looming large at the conference table, and China's role in that war is increasingly pivotal. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said recently that any provision of lethal aid by China to Russia would be a historic mistake with profound implications. What would those implications be, Ambassador?
The implications are how it's really going to be affecting the war. As you know, we're very concerned, NATO countries, about the sovereignty of Ukraine, and in particular for the U.S., you know, just maintaining our support to Ukraine to maintain its sovereignty.
But if it's China, not some other country, throwing its weight into this war, I mean, isn't that an especially big worry for NATO?
It is a concern, and we see the growing relationship between Russia and the PRC. So, you know, those kind of things is particularly worrisome, and we really don't want to see that happen.
Yeah, fair enough. But when French President Emmanuel Macron visited Beijing recently, he got this really warm welcome from Chinese President Xi Jinping. Macron came back to France and gave an interview saying, on China policy, European countries were too subservient to the U.S. and shouldn't be Washington's followers or vassals. Those were his words. Many European leaders talk about the need for strategic autonomy. So how does that fit with NATO's agenda?
There continue to be different approaches and different ways of looking at situations, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there cannot be an overall way in which we approach something and look at something. So having those statements by President Macron doesn't necessarily indicate that there's not unity by NATO itself. I mean, you have independent countries, of course.
In recent weeks, Ambassador, hundreds of apparently classified U.S. documents showed up in social media feeds. U.S. officials have confirmed that most of the documents appear to be genuine. How are the NATO allies gathering now in Washington reacting to that leak?
U.S. officials are engaging with our allies and partners at many levels and high levels on the issue of these leaks. And we are reassuring them of our commitment to safeguarding intelligence and the fidelity of our security partnerships.
David Sanger at the New York Times described one of the leaked documents as full of what-if scenarios. It suggested U.S. diplomats were discussing what happens if the Ukrainians get hold of a missile that has the reach to get into Moscow and maybe hit the Kremlin. How would the Russians respond? Would this lead Putin to set off a tactical nuclear weapon, etc.? I mean, you're surely not dismissing those what-ifs. How are you discussing them with other diplomats?
No, I have to say I'm not going against those what-ifs, as you said, but I can say, you know, and we'll see this week if there are going to be any questions or issues on that. But if you're talking about missiles or things like that, I mean, these are the kind of issues that, you know, this group would be looking at and discussing. We're still working and reassuring them of our commitments to safeguarding the intelligence and our security partnerships.
Can you give us an example of one concrete thing, Ambassador, that you hope to get done at this gathering, but that right now is not at all guaranteed?
I think what's not guaranteed is what the future is going to be looking like. We're dealing with a situation right now where we see a changing landscape in Europe. We're seeing a country that's still within another country that had invaded. We don't have a lot of guarantees about the future in terms of emerging technologies. I think we're at a place right now where we're trying to look at the existing landscape, which is changing. We don't have a lot of answers, but I think what this conference is going to do is allow experts to sit around and really discuss these issues.
Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins is the U.S. Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, speaking with us at the start of this week's NATO conference in Washington that she's chairing on arms control, disarmament, and weapons of mass destruction nonproliferation. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
In Berlin, anti-nuke activists celebrated and others protested as Germany shut down its last three nuclear power plants over the weekend. Conservatives say Germany's making a huge mistake to not invest in the technology and that today's nuclear reactors are much safer than the plants built decades ago. They insist there's no way to make significant cuts in global carbon emissions without it. Even as Germany moves away from nuclear power, they've invested heavily in renewables, it still has to figure out what to do with all the toxic waste their reactors have produced over the years. The country's environment minister recently said nuclear power supplied electricity for three generations, but its legacy remains dangerous for 30,000 generations. This next story contains details that will be difficult for some of you to hear. Please take care while listening. This is about a Syrian-American man who is suing the government of Syria for how they treated him in prison. Obada Mazayik says he was detained and tortured in Syria in 2012. Now, in a civil lawsuit filed in a U.S. court, he wants justice, not just for himself, but for other Syrians who've been through the same experience. The world's Shirin Jafari spoke with him and brings us that story.
Obada Mazayik says he can't forget the voices he heard during his time in prison in Syria.
The torture, the physical torture I got, I can forget easily, no problem.
But those like scenes that I listen and I hear, they are unforgettable. I cannot like forget them.
Mosaic was born in the US but moved to Syria with his parents when he was 4 years old. He was studying civil engineering when the protests began in 2011. He was arrested for the first time that year, accused of taking part in demonstrations. He was released after about a month. But then he got arrested again a year later. This time, he wasn't as lucky.
They hanged me from the wall. They put their hands on my neck and they like hanged me on the wall. They almost killed me at that time.
Mosaic describes long hours of interrogation. He was moved from one detention facility to another. He was kicked and punched, he says, beaten with a PVC pipe. But all this, he says, was nothing compared to what he heard.
I can hear the screaming, shouting. One night I heard like a small kid, I don't know his age, but he was shouting, like asking for his mom to help him out.
There were times, he says, he wished he'd die instead of enduring this agonizing experience. Mosaic was released after his father paid off some officials. He says it took months for him to recover from his wounds and leave the country. And now, more than a decade, to file this lawsuit.
I should do this way long time ago, but I didn't feel safe and secure before that. Now I feel more secure, of course, and I feel like more sense of responsibility to hold the Syrian regime accountable.
There have been other cases against the Syrian government in U.S. courts, says Daniel McLaughlin, one of the lawyers involved in Mosaic's case. For example, in 2019, a U.S. court ordered the Syrian government to pay $300 million for the death of journalist Mary Colvin.
You know, this suit is part of a sort of broader constellation of accountability efforts, some of which are ongoing in the U.S., some of which are ongoing in Europe.
He says these cases are difficult to bring forward in the U.S. because foreign sovereigns are immune from being sued. But there are exceptions for countries that the U.S. calls state sponsors of terrorism, like Syria. It's unlikely that the Syrian government will defend itself in a U.S. court, but McLaughlin says it's important for these cases to be heard in a court of law.
But also, you know, in the current context, there's been a push towards sort of a renormalization of the Assad regime at the international level. And so we would think that having a U.S. court document that, you know, there's a system-wide policy of detention, torture, extrajudicial killing, that can help sort of combat against the push towards the rehabilitation of the Assad regime.
Any glimmer of hope about holding Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his officials accountable is welcomed by families who've lost loved ones or are still searching for them, according to the Center for Justice and Accountability, which is involved in Mosaic's case. More than 130,000 Syrians remain missing or detained.
I've had that call from my sister saying that my brother never came back home.
Hala's brother disappeared on April 13, 2013. She has asked we only use her first name because her family is in Syria. She's in the UK. Hala was an activist and involved in the peaceful demonstrations in 2011. Her brother, Subhi, was 21 and studying mechanical engineering. He had just received a scholarship to study in Germany.
He's so clever, intellectual, and he's just so good person.
Hala says Subhi didn't take part in protests like she did. That's why all these years she's been puzzled about why he would be the one targeted.
It should have been me, not him. So there is an element of guilt.
Hala says through therapy, she's come to realize that it's the Syrian government who's responsible, not her. Hala's family has been through hell, she says. They've paid huge sums of money in exchange for information that turned out to be false or no information at all.
So not even that they were trying to take money. They were playing with my mom's feelings and heart.
Hala says she's glad that Obada Mosaic has brought this case to a U.S. court, but she's also managing her expectations. She says she knows these cases aren't going to bring the detainees home.
For me, it's more about preserving our narratives, saying the truth about what happened, telling the world about our suffering.
She hopes that as countries like Tunisia and Saudi Arabia rush to reopen embassies and restore ties with Syria, they're also reminded of the stories of thousands of Syrians like her brother who are still missing or detained. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
For centuries, one of Europe's driest regions has been lush and fertile. thanks to the ingenious use of canals and gravity. We're talking about the area around Granada in Andalusia in southern Spain. This was an Arab kingdom for some 800 years, and the Moors, as they were known, were experts in water engineering. Today, much of their knowledge and the network of waterways they built have been lost. As Jerry Haddon reports from Granada, archaeologists are digging up these waterways and recovering an ancient form of irrigation.
High above the city of Granada, on a recent morning, a man with a gray ponytail walks his dogs along the edge of a winding, dusty trench. His name is Jesus Salvador. When he was a kid, he says, this was a canal flowing with water. He used to hike up here to a waterfall.
Entonces, si hay invierno, hace mucho frío.
If the winter was cold, he says, the waterfall would freeze. It was 15 feet high. In warmer weather, he says, a mist came off this canal, and these hillsides were covered with green moss. And below, at the end, there was a great place to swim, he says, called the Pool of the Moors. Aptly named, as the Moors built this now abandoned canal, or acequia, as they're called in Spanish. All told, the acequias form a complex network some 1,800 miles long, snaking down from the snowy Sierra Nevada mountains to the plains. For over 1,000 years, they were the source of water here, for people, for pools, and for agriculture, until about 50 years ago, when people began abandoning the countryside, says archaeologist Elena Correa from the University of Granada.
Esta zona, como vemos ahora mismo, se encuentra prácticamente abandonada, lo que son las zonas de terraza y huerta y campo de cultivo. También tenemos algunos cortijos, como vemos aquí.
People just abandoned all these terraces, she says. She points to some abandoned farmhouses further up the brown mountainside. We've found tons of garbage up here, she says, and tons of dirt and sediment filling in the canal over these last 50 years. Correa and her team, along with hundreds of volunteers, have spent the last year restoring and cleaning this acequia. Its historic importance is unmatched, she says, as it once provided all the drinking water to the seat of Moorish power in Granada, the Albaicín. The Albaicín is a hillside maze of cobbled lanes and whitewashed homes, a mix of Moorish and Spanish architecture, with the Alhambra fortress looming just in front. It's a huge tourist draw. But these days, the water that trickles from the Albaicín's many fountains is pumped by modern machinery. A millennium ago, residents here had gravity and gravity alone to thank. Originally, Granada's water all came cascading down from here, this natural spring some 10 miles into the mountains. This is the Fountain of Tears, a stone reservoir named after the teardrop shape its creators gave it. We inherited this from the Arab farmers, says Luis Miguel Ortega. He's the head of the region's irrigation authority. The know-how most likely came from ancient Persia, Syria, and Jordan, he says. The Fountain of Tears is still in use, providing water to a couple of close-by hamlets. Its water is crystal clear, if low, due to a lack of rainfall. Ortega explains what he calls the real genius behind the acequias. Further up in the Sierra Nevada mountains, he says, there are canals that are not for watering crops directly. They run horizontally along the range until all of their water just seeps away into the earth. It might seem wasted, Ortega says, but the water is filtering down the mountainside. That's why far below the canals, he says, you find fruit trees and crops that normally wouldn't flourish at such high and dry altitudes. To reach the highest of these acequias, you drive a dirt switchback a couple of hours up to about 7,000 feet above sea level. Here, above the tree line, runs the Acequia de los Hechos. It's about 3 miles long, and it's a seeper, meant to feed aquifers below. Not long after I arrive, a tractor comes around the corner. Driving it is farmer Alejandro Molina, a guy with thick black whiskers. He's just been tending to his potatoes and chestnut trees on his ranch far below. The canal here provides water to all the farms you see below, says Molina. If you were to cut off the acequia, everything would dry up within 2 months. This place, he says, would become a desert. Molina says he's worried that's exactly what's happening because it didn't snow this year, and snowmelt is the source of all the water up here and all the way down the mountain. Back at the acequia just above Granada, archaeologist Elena Correa and her team hike up the canal. Today, after months of work, they open the sluice. The water begins as a gush, but soon it's a trickle. Some half a mile from the city, it's gone altogether. It's supposed to reach the University of Granada to be used for watering the grounds. But this is just the start, Correa says. Right now, this is an arid stretch without water, she says. But if you look upstream to where the water is, you can see the ecosystem it generates, the biodiversity around it. It's rejuvenating. Where there's water, there's life, Correa says. Let's just hope it rains again soon. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Granada, Spain.
Today, a major upset at the finish of the 127th Boston Marathon.
Evans Chebet of Kenya takes the 127th Boston Marathon title. Evans
Chebet! Also at the finish line in Boston's Back Bay was GBH reporter Esteban Bustillos, who's going to fill us in on what happened today. Esteban, Evans Chebet won the marathon last year, but he was not expected to come in first today. What's the story there?
Yeah, so coming in this year, Eliud Kipchoge, who is widely regarded as the best marathon runner ever, he was running Boston for the first year, and he actually finished in sixth place today on the men's side. So upset is a funny thing to say for somebody who is defending champion in Evans Chebet, and he's actually the first man to repeat as champion since 2008. Upset is a funny word,
right?
But it was definitely a bit of a shocking result.
Well, I don't want to jerk the spotlight away from Evans Chebet. I mean, he won fair and square. Eliud Kipchoge, as you said, from Kenya, is considered the greatest marathon runner in the world in the past. He's called the Boston Marathon a tricky, hilly beast of a course. So how did his performance today compare with his record-breaking win last year in the Berlin Marathon?
Right. So last year in Berlin, Kipchoge, he set the official world record at 2:01:09. He's the first person to ever break the two-hour mark. That was in a special event in 2019 that technically didn't count for world record purposes. But, you know, he comes in, he's sort of the star power. But there was a slip-up at one of the water stations. It appears he wasn't able to grab his water as he had hoped. You know, I can't say exactly what happened to him, but it appeared that may have slowed him down.
Yeah, we'll just say that every second counts, right?
True.
Now, Helen Obiri of Kenya won the women's marathon. What can you tell us about her?
Yeah, Helen Obiri, this is only her second marathon. She's actually more of a track athlete. She won silver medals in the 5,000-meter events at the Rio Olympics in 2016 and the Olympics in 2021 in Tokyo. But that track speed, it just translated, and she won on the women's side.
Amazing. Looking at the rest of the field, Esteban, was there one country that dominated this year?
The big story is just Evans Chebet, again, winning 2 years in a row. That is, on the men's side, that will be the fourth year in a row that a Kenyan runner has won the marathon on the men's side. So I think that sort of continued representation from Kenyan athletes is a big deal.
Yeah, Kenya always flexing. Now, the Boston Marathon is one of the world's great classic courses. Some 30,000 people on it today from more than 100 different countries. I know you spoke with a bunch of them. What did you hear?
Yeah, so one of the people I spoke to was Kate Matheson. This is the first Boston Marathon for Kate, who's from Bristol, England. She says it took many years to finally qualify.
Boston isn't a huge thing in the UK, but my American friends were all very excited when people qualified for Boston, and it was something, once I started running marathons, that I just wanted to be able to say I had done.
I also spoke to Mari Diaz from Chile. She ran the virtual Boston Marathon in 2020, which, if you remember, COVID canceled the in-person race, so folks just ran it wherever they could back in 2020. This was her first time running it in person, and she had plenty of company.
There was a group of more than 100 runners coming from Chile. We met as a group to take a picture, and it's the biggest group ever.
I also spoke to Catherine Berry, who's 70, from Nova Scotia, and Catherine had three goals for today's race.
One is to enjoy myself, two is to finish, three is to finish under 6 hours.
Way to go, Catherine. Now, Esteban, Bostonians and runners were well aware that this year marks the 10th anniversary of the bombing attack at the finish line in 2013. How were people remembering that tragedy today? What did you see?
You know, it wasn't really as much today as I saw over the weekend. You know, on Saturday, Boston had two special ceremonies on the actual 10th anniversary of the bombing. I think, in general, the sense I got was that this sort of 10 years was sort of a much needed catharsis. You know, in 2020, obviously, in-person marathon got canceled. This year, the first year, we didn't necessarily have to talk about COVID, but now we're talking about the 10-year anniversary of the bombing. So I think now we can finally look forward and move forward to 2024, when hopefully that's when we'll get the chance to just talk about the marathon as the marathon.
Esteban, before you go, quickly recap the results, the winners, and their times, please.
Yeah, so the men's side, Evans Chebet of Kenya, he won with a time of 2:05.54. And on the women's side, Helen Obiri, she won with a time of 2:21.38.
And we continue to chase that elusive two-hour marathon. Esteban Bustillos, reporter for GBH, updating us near the finish line of today's Boston Marathon. Thank you very much, Esteban.
Thanks, Marco.
In the desert of Southern California, 21-year-old singer named Ileana pulled a first at one of the world's high-profile music festivals. She sang a full set entirely in Arabic at Coachella. The festival is known as much for the huge musical acts it attracts as the bohemian fashions that goers wear under the hot sun of the Imperial Valley. You can hear a bit of keyboard there. That's Ileana's brother. He's in the band. Ileana is Palestinian and Chilean, but it's her Arabic roots that are most present in her music. You can hear this in her two albums, Ileana and the follow-up, Ileana 2. Ileana was born in the Israeli city of Nazareth. She grew up in a Palestinian family, a family that carried Israeli passports. Unlike most Palestinians, she comes from a Christian family. They only account for a tiny percentage today. It was her keyboard-playing brother who encouraged her to take music seriously after he heard her sing. Ileana's family has always been hugely supportive. Her dad once spotted Wassim Slaby, the Lebanese music impresario who manages pop icon The Weeknd, and he said to Ileana, "Inshallah, he'll be your manager." Her family moved to San Diego when she was 16, where Ileana attended high school. Wassim Slaby, the music manager, actually ended up meeting Ileana and agreed to represent her. It was Slaby who convinced her to perform only in Arabic, a rarity in American commercial pop.
So I grew up in these two worlds, and of course they influenced me, and of course they had a huge impact on me as a person and as an artist.
So her work is something of a cultural mashup, but it doesn't compromise on her Arab identity. This is an Egyptian pop hit called Ena Lehelli that she's made her own. Here's how Ileana sang it on TikTok, unplugged and acoustic, her guitarist on the edge of a car, like a good San Diegan in a beach parking lot. Her vibe is part singer-songwriter, but on stage, she's more hip-shaking Shakira. One young woman in the front row filming the set with her phone cries as she watches. When she left the stage, Ileana waved a black and white keffiyeh, once worn by Palestinian farmers and now a symbol of Palestinian nationalism. Singing in Arabic has never been part of mainstream American music, but maybe Ileana at Coachella will change that. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
From PRX.